Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. All right, let's turn to the young men and young women's programs. And I'm going to just turn the time over to Heather and Lori. What, you know, I have daughters and young women, and everything's going great. So let's start by saying, what would be concerns that we should have about, you know, red flags or issues that a daughter might face that a progressive or an unorthodox LDS person should watch out for or maybe, you know, be concerned about? Why would we even have this as an issue on the table?
Well, are we're making a list?
Well, it's just to set the context. There are some, you know, we have all sorts of listeners. So, like, there's some listeners who are true believers and who've never thought about any of this. And there are others who are doubters and hate everything. It's just a level setting, not to gripe, but just like, let's set the table of what are some of the things that you guys have been frustrated with that you've had to try and navigate as non-traditional believers.
The biggest thing for me is just the gender roles. And that's everywhere, but it has become a bigger issue for me, much bigger. The transition for me in terms of my kids, dealing with that issue in my kids, when my oldest moved from primary to young women was absolutely huge, like massive tectonic plates shifting. I felt like we went from lessons in primary about service, how you can help people in your family, being nice to other people. Yeah, we get the obedience thing. I mean, there's other things, but we went basically from a much more principles base to lots more talk about gender roles, the divine role of women. So somehow it became a little, I'm not being very articulate.
You're doing great.
It became more dogmatic, I guess. And so there were more things for me that were objectionable to me once she got into young women. She also has told me that not a week goes by that they don't talk about chastity. So that went from, we don't talk about that in primary. I mean, we might talk about wearing modest clothes, which I think is a conversation that can also get really obnoxious, but I think there's a lot of good to it also. We talk about that at our house, you know, why you wouldn't want to dress like a hoochie mama. That's what my youngest son refers to it as. But why did she turn 12 and then all of a sudden start hearing about chastity? She didn't even know what that meant. So that's worrisome to me. Why? I mean, I almost feel like it's sort of filling their heads with ideas that they're not ready for and that they don't need. And it's tiresome to her. I mean, she loves young women, but she often rolls her eyes and says, well, every single week we talk about chastity. So that's tiresome. I don't know. What do you want to add to the list, Lori?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is when I really started to struggle with my testimony, was in the young women's program as a teenager. There was no talk of women going on missions. It was always men. The equality in the different activities that the girls would have, that the boys would have. Mm-hmm. Boys were going on high adventure things, and we're lucky to get the money to have an ice cream party, you know, and then we're always baking something in the kitchen, and there's this idea that boys want sex and girls don't, and then you find yourself with your boyfriend, and you know what, you want it too, and you're not taught that that's normal, so, you know, what's going on with you? And for me, just so much talk about getting married. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful Laurel teacher. And I remember her taking the manual. I must have been 17. And we looked up to her. She was gorgeous and hip, and she was a lawyer. And she took this manual, and she tossed it aside. And she goes, in good consciousness, I cannot teach you one more lesson on eternal marriage. And mm-hmm. She goes, you guys need to learn to get ready for college. We're going to talk about college prep. And I was so grateful to her because she didn't placate to us the way everybody else did. I was tired of being treated like an innocent young thing. Mm. And I was smarter than that. and I wanted to be treated smarter, and I want my girls to be treated smarter. It's going to be a challenge when my daughter turns 13, figuring out how to counterbalance all those messages that they suddenly get when they're going through this phase. You know, when girls hit 9 and 10, they're so much more aware than boys typically of how the world sees them and who they should be and how they should behave. And the world's very quick to teach them how to behave. And we want the girls to be true to themselves and to listen to their voice and not lose that connection. And I'm going to be watching with an eagle eye when my daughter turns 12.
But it also, the time that they spend with people also easily doubles. So you go from primary where they get 45 minutes with a primary teacher and then about that same amount of time with, you know, the primary presidency, on, and that's it. And then they're getting together on Wednesday nights, every Wednesday night. And then they have firesides, and then they have Bishop's Youth discussions, and then sometimes they'll go to the temple, and that takes all day where we live. So there's so many more opportunities for them to be with other leaders. So, I mean, just in sheer minutes alone, that that's a big jump. And I feel like they get to a place where, I mean, I feel like it was interesting that Lee and Lori, both of you guys, and maybe John too, were saying that what parents say carries a lot more weight. But I feel like for me, that has shifted a little bit too. And that's been hard for me to see. And I think that that's normal, although I don't think this is what you guys were saying, so maybe I'm just wrong. I feel like my daughter is moving to a place where now she is paying more attention to what other adults say. Maybe not more than she does to me, but definitely more than she has in the past. So she has these leaders in young women's that she sees a lot more, and she's developing relationships with them, and she's getting to where she respects them a lot. And so I think it's actually easier for my younger kids to hear something silly and say, you know, at church, well, I don't believe that. But for my older daughter, who I think is, I think part of it is the depth of the relationships that she's developing just due to that time. She's paying more heed to that than she used to. So it's becoming harder, you know, for her to sit in the car and say, oh, I do think it's true that men are in charge of everything. That's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, that's like a knife in my gut, basically. And that may be her just pulling my, you know, yanking my chain a little bit. But that's hard to swallow. Or I can just feel like, oh, I'm losing a little bit of my... I'm losing a little bit of my authority. I'm having to cede some of that to other people. That's hard.
Well, this is my concern, too. And this is when I cross the line of that the church is good and useful to the church is damaging, right? When do you cross that line when they're crossing your family values of equality and tolerance? For me, it's the same with the gay issue. You know, I'm going to stand up. And I'm going to say it clearly and loudly. It's not okay, this discrimination of teenagers, women in the church. It's just not okay. It's not helpful. And, you know, I want her to go if she wants to. If she gets good friends and friendships and connection out of it, I would be okay with that. But it's still one of the last untouched frontiers between my husband and I of how to navigate.
Well, Lee, you've raised at least three daughters who have seemed to come out of this, you know, at least not completely destroyed. Do you have any tips or tricks on how to navigate these waters with young women?
I think we weren't completely successful. I think our daughters challenged us on many occasions, and that was a healthy dynamic. But I think if we did anything well with our kids, it was... taking a very balanced approach with how we grounded virtually everything they were experiencing in life with how they could stay in charge of it, how they could control their own lives and do things that would support the formation of their own identities and their own values. And when I would get out of line occasionally and kind of move a little unaware into more of an authority role, Marilyn would always jokingly say, see that jar over there on the table? That's where your father's going to keep his testicles if he starts acting up too much in the future. And, you know, my daughter's got a kick out of that. That was so we always had a healthy disregard for dogma and conformity and playing the rules by someone else's game plan when we didn't have an opportunity to weigh in on the content and the commitment of that game plan. I taught my kids from a very early age, and Marilyn was there with me every step of the way. Context is every bit as important as text, meaning how you live your life and where you make your commitments and how you exhibit and how you perform on a day-to-day basis is every bit as important as the scriptures or the rules that have been presented to you.
Right.
My daughters are feminists, and I'm proud to say that they learned that from a feminist father.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Amen.
Hallelujah.
Yes. And I hold that feminism still is the best thing that's ever happened to men. I look around the church. I look around the church and I see all these men with their babies. We've got great men in the church, great fathers. Men taking babies out and interacting with their kids, things that didn't happen before the women's movement. It benefits everybody to focus on this equality. I can remember being 18. Did you guys have golden green balls where you were?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, right, the boys work so hard to earn these Eagle Scouts. They work their tails off. Years and years of scouting. And the girls just basically show up and wear a pretty dress and walk down this thing. And all the girls were failing out of high school my year. They all wanted to be marine biologists. And they were presented as these intelligent creatures. And I was just rolling my eyes. And I refused to do it. I felt I did not want to be a trophy walking down a stage for not achieving anything. So I remember my mother on the phone with her friend who was the young women's president. They're very good friends. And the young women's president was trying to convince my mother to put me in the golden green ball because I was, quote, such a good example. And I've never been prouder of my mom, her on the phone saying, I've taught my daughter her whole life to do what she thinks is right. And I am not going to influence her to do something that's not. That doesn't feel right to her. And so she stood up for me, and I think, you know, that's what we can do for our girls is stand up for them, give them an equal playing field. The dads are huge. Dads are huge in how you treat your daughters. And
hey, John?
Yeah.
Laurie's message just inspired a memory that I think is worth sharing here. I was in the bishopric in my ward back in the early, mid-80s, and my daughters were just becoming of young women age, and when my oldest daughter turned 12, we recommended that we take all of the young kids in the ward up to Timpanogos Cave from the backside and do a little bit of mountain climbing, teach the kids how to climb up the mountain very careful, very experienced ways. We had to jump through enormous hoops to do this. And so we had to modify the activity, and we went to a waterfall on the backside of Timpanogos Cave. And while it was beautiful and really stunning to look at, as we were enjoying the scenery, we all of a sudden look up, and there are about 20 people rappelling down the mountainside, and they're doing it in an absolutely expert way. They're well equipped, they're well toned, and they are enjoying this activity immensely. They get to the bottom of it, and we think it's the Sierra Club or some other organization, and we ask them who they are and where they're from, and and they're all women. And one of the older women, about 18 years old, said, "We're in the Heber City 4th Ward."
Yeah.
On our young women's activity. And the bishop of the ward, who had really gone to great lengths to try to cut through bureaucratic tape to make this happen, but ran into all kinds of obstacles, just was speechless. And but he went back and he wrote letters, and he made a commitment from that point on: I will always keep my advocacy hat on, and I'm not always going to believe the dogmatic response that is given to me as doctrine, because there's always a different way of looking at it. Gave my daughter, and because of that experience, her friends, a very different way of looking at their experience with the church, and how they could drive some of this stuff themselves.
Hmm. Good stuff.
I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. This has been very good. Any final words from the women about young women before I change the subject a bit? Are you guys good?
I just wish that the women had the power to change the program. That's my wish. That's my dream. You know.
Well, they used to. They used to.
Yeah. It's people on the local level doing, you know, asking forgiveness instead of permission.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that I sort of wish, and this is me, you know, totally imposing my worldview, I wish that more of the women could see that it needed to be changed.
Yes.
Because that's sometimes frustrating for me, where I feel like, wow. I mean, and I used to think, man, am I the only one that feels like this? I don't think that anymore, but... I mean, I can't count the number of conversations that I've had with people, women and men, where I've explained some of my issues around gender, and they're completely befuddled. They've never thought about it. They've never seen it that way. I mean, I talked to one of Brent's friends once who was saying, Heather, I got to be honest with you. You know, I've never thought of anything of any of this, and my wife has never mentioned a single one of these complaints or issues that you've raised. You know, and it's kind of like, how do you respond to that? Because then it ends up looking like you're just, you know, a naysayer. And I'm like, well, it's really not me. It's not only me. But, yeah, I mean, I think although I should just acknowledge that for a lot of women, obviously the church really works and is a very friendly, affirming place. And sometimes the world, I can't believe I just said that, is disdainful of women who choose to have children and stay home and make that be their primary thing. And so in that regard, obviously the church is a very welcoming place because that's really the thing that you're expected to do. So if that's something that you want, the church is really a beautiful organization that's very supportive of that. But if you're not, you're walking on eggshells, I guess.
This is where all of our parenting comes into play. I raise kids who aren't afraid to ask the questions and who aren't so conditioned that they accept that as normal. I mean, we feel like the people stirring up trouble just by saying, hey, we don't want a man to babysit us on our young women's activity, right? We don't have to have a priesthood holder there all the time. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Hopefully... the next generation won't feel bad to use their voices.
Well, I have a scary thought. It might be scary to some. And that's just that we have several thousand listeners to this podcast. And if people can take just Heather's story alone of what she did in primary and start applying it, you know, that's one. And let's just say that's one in every ward in the U.S. I do believe that we can make a change over time, a constructive change. Not a disruptive one, but a constructive one. Maybe I'm foolish, and I don't mean to get too caught up in what we're doing, but I guess I have to admit that there's a part of me that hopes that maybe we can each do our part to see something aggregate into something that paints the world that you guys are wishing for. Again, Heather, you're going to tell me I'm wishful thinking, right? Crazy.
Well, no. Well, it's good. You know, Don Quixote, right? He, you know. Windmills. I have to admit that I feel a little bit like that too, for selfish reasons, perhaps. I mean, I don't think at all like, oh, because I did that, any big change was wrought. But I do think, well, I'm 36, so I've got a lot of years, hopefully, left on this planet, and so do my kids. And so if I make it more amenable, the experience, for me and for my kids, then that's enough. I don't really need to worry about, you know, anybody else. But I hope, you know, that was part of my thinking when I got up to bear my testimony on Sunday. That was in reaction to some talk that was going on about how temple weddings were the only ones that counted. And I was just sitting there thinking, wow, I can't believe I'm in this room that is actually full of a lot of people who did not get married in the temple. And we're now, someone very well-meaning was trying to say that temple marriage is important, but also ended up saying that, you know, there's temple marriages and there's civil marriages, and temple marriages are the only ones that count. And I just thought, I can't be in this room and let this go down. So that was part of my thinking. And I actually said to my husband, make sure the kids listen, because I thought I need them to get another message besides that one. And so I did. I said, I'm a doubter. And I said, I get very nervous when we label people and we say that someone's inactive, someone's LDS, someone's not LDS, someone's partially active, part member family. I said, I feel like we pity people sometimes that are not members of our church because we feel like the thing that we have is so much better. And I said, I just don't believe that. I said, I think that God loves everyone and that there's good everywhere. And I try to look for that everywhere. So, and then when I sat down, I thought, well, I feel better now. I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I turned that experience for myself, at least anyway, and maybe for my husband. He was happy, but I don't know about anybody else, but I couldn't worry about that. For me, that made it a better experience.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe I should be more visionary, but at the end of the day, I just want to put my head on my own pillow and feel good about it, you know, mm-hmm. what I said and what I didn't say, and that can bring a lot of peace.
Mm-hmm.
To dream the impossible dream. Sorry, everyone. No, well said. I think you guys are much more practical and pragmatic and level-headed, and I'm a fool.
And John, look at this. Just one comment from me on this. My mother is 82 years old. When she attended young women programs and church when she was growing up, there was only one option for Latter-day Saint women. Raise a big family and be a faithful wife.
Yeah.
That was fulfilling enough. the baby boomers started raising concerns about that, and the social revolution and the sexual revolution of the late 60s, 70s had a transforming effect on the church as well. And it's small growth, but it's incremental. What we started getting in the late 70s and early 80s was, you better get an education in case you don't get married.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughters, growing up in becoming teenagers in the late 80s, early 90s, into the mid 90s, got a different message. And while you still have some of the stereotypical messages that it's fulfilling enough to live an honorable life being a mother and a wife, they grew up feeling distinctly that wasn't quite enough to live the self-actuated life. Even in the church, with really good, very savvy, very intelligent, and spiritual young women advisors, my daughters got the message that you want to be a complete person, and maybe, just maybe, being a good wife and a mother will not fill you completely. That's progress.
It is. Yeah, maybe in 30, 40 years, it'll be the perfect experience for our great-grandchildren.
Yeah. And maybe, just maybe, someday we'll stop saying, as an excuse, well, boys will be boys and the men run the church.
That's going to take longer than 40 years.
But we've been working on it a long time. How's that working for us?
Well, let's go ahead, Laura. Let's have a segue about boys being boys and talk about something that's probably a little bit uncomfortable. I want to talk about masturbation. Before we talk about sexuality, both between boys and girls, it's a sensitive topic, and it's one that I'm not sure where the church stands today on it. I know the impression I got growing up, which is that masturbation is evil and dirty and horrible, and you shouldn't do it, and you're wicked and nasty if you do. And that's kind of to some extent today, I still have that inkling in me because it's kind of how I was raised. But, as I understand progressives and forward-thinking people, sometimes, you know, there's this view that that's just normal, that that's just what everyone does and no one admits it, and it's healthy. And the only thing that's dangerous about masturbation is when it's excessive or when it's stigmatized, and that stigmatization can wreak all sorts of havoc in terms of guilt and making people live split lives and becoming deceitful and all sorts of horrible things that can come from making people feel horrible about it.
Yeah, well, the other dangerous part is getting caught.
Oh. Okay, yeah, well, I can imagine. So I haven't, you know, a lot of people ask me how I'm going to deal with this with my son. Does anybody want to talk about how they think a good approach is to deal with this topic?
I put it around those values. The sexuality, the substances, word of wisdom, all of those things for me fall under the values. And for me, the value is being smart, right? So when you're choosing how to handle your body, who you're going to engage with, what you're going to drink, what you're not going to drink, make a smart decision. Like, this is, you know, I had the talk with my son, and he had a bishop's interview, and it was brought up, and we had to talk about it after. And I said, people are going to give you lots of suggestions. It's a really normal thing, and you're going to have to be okay with whatever you decide to do or not do. And I left it at that. It's his body. It's his decision. And he can internalize that the way he needs to. I've got to step out of that one.
So that raises another issue, though, about the whole interviewing process.
Yes. Let's pause. Let's finish the masturbation discussion in and of itself, and then we'll go to the interviews, because that's a separate topic, if that's okay. Sorry, Heather. Sorry.
No, well, they are separate topics, because I feel like I can say whatever I want to say. I can say, and I suppose, although usually we talk about it in terms of boys, that it would be also be an issue for girls. Right. Although I will say that I can't recall a single conversation all the years that I was in Young Women about masturbation. I don't remember ever being told anything about that, whether good or, well, certainly not good, but not bad. And I think that that's very, at least judging from my husband, the only person that I'm close enough to say, you know, hey, let's talk about masturbation. What are your experiences in the church with that? That was very different. He said it was talked about a lot. But so I can say all I want. It's normal. Be smart with your body. I mean, Lori, I think that's a very good message. But the issue does remain that they could get prodded about that.
Sure.
And then how do they deal with it? Or do we tell them to be honest and then let the chips fall where they may? Or do we tell? I mean, I don't know how to
tell them. It's their own business, and they're okay to tell any adult that's not your business. That's my take on it.
Okay.
It's personal things you own. They're personal.
But and yes,
I don't have the right to ask you if you're masturbating. Come on. And some man who barely knows you, I mean,
yes,
you know, who spends 1 hour a week with you is going to ask you that? I don't think
right.
so. And what about the girls? Because, you know, if we're going to teach boys about it, don't you think the girls aren't doing it? I mean, come on.
Okay, let's just dispel that myth right now. Do teenage girls do that?
Hormones, yes.
But is it probably a lot less common?
It's probably a lot less common.
Okay.
But yes, they do.
Okay.
Yeah, I would just say, I don't know.
It's on the increase.
It's probably on the increase.
Yeah. That's according to my daughter, the marriage and family therapist.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Lee, before we talk about interviews, Lee, do you have anything to add to Lori's wonderful advice about how to deal with that topic, or do you think she nailed it?
I think she nailed it.
Okay.
Yeah. It resonated with me. I liked what you said.
Okay. So let's go on to, Heather, the topic you brought up. And I'll just say that I've actually heard of 12 or 13-year-old girls being asked by their bishop whether they masturbate when they didn't even know what the word meant. And that's an extreme example. But boys get it all the time. And we've just said that one of the things you can do is teach your children to tell them it's none of their business, but I don't want to let my 12-year-old, I don't want to introduce that topic to my 12-year-old necessarily. I don't know that 12 is the age where I want to have that discussion. What about how to handle those worthiness interviews other than telling your kid to tell the leader that it's none of their business. Do you guys have any approaches you've taken to deal with those?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, go ahead, Heather.
Well, I was just going to say, we talked about this before Kennedy turned 12, and we sort of agreed that we were going to ask the bishopric or explain to the bishopric that it made us uncomfortable for her to be in a room with a closed door with them, even though they were, of course, perfectly nice, you know, people. I thought that would be an awkward conversation, but I'm just saying we had sort of agreed that we were going to do that. And she got called in to have one of those interviews before we even had an opportunity to have that conversation. And I really wasn't happy. And that's happened a couple of times. She actually also got set apart once, and they didn't tell us or ask us to be involved in that. And so part of me is like, well, okay, it's a volunteer organization. They probably just were trying to get it done. And part of me was annoyed to have been sort of left out of that, even if it was, you know, just accidental. But it made her very uncomfortable. She told me that they didn't ask her about masturbation. If that, I mean, I interrupted you when you were talking about that, John, but if someone were to ask Kennedy that, a man were to ask her that behind closed doors, I would absolutely, that would be my undoing and the undoing of the first person that I ran into. I mean, that would just absolutely enrage me.
Will there be testicles in a jar?
I don't even know what there would be. But she just told me afterwards, she said it made it uncomfortable, and it wasn't only the sexual questions. She said that, and I think it was for a temple trip. But she didn't really like being asked what she believed about things either, and that's sort of just her personality. But I think she felt uncomfortable, and she felt nervous, and she felt sort of intimidated. So to me, it's a question that pertains not only just to questions of sexuality, but just of being in a room with an adult, and it's someone who's in charge of you, and they're going to sign this piece of paper or not, according to whether you say the right answers. That makes me very uncomfortable. So we have asked her to please, if someone comes, because they seem to have this habit of just coming and grabbing them out of young women or Sunday school to do these interviews.
Right.
And we've just asked her to please, if that happens, to just say, well, just a minute, I need to go get my mom or my dad. Now, it hasn't happened since we've told her that. And she doesn't like that either, because she knows that that's not what's usually done. So she's not really uncomfortable, you know, she's not really comfortable with that herself. So we're sort of in the middle of trying to negotiate that, and it's very hard.
Lori, you got any experience with this?
Well, I've got this 14-year-old son. He goes on the temple trips, and he's so mature in so many ways. I just talked to him about it after, you know, what they ask you. He seems to be able to handle himself just fine. I tell him, it's so hard because you want to empower them that no adult, right, in a room with a closed door should have any power over them. But how do they not feel that, you know? He doesn't seem fazed by it at all. And I've asked him point blank, and he's like, yeah, they talk about that, you know, and he kind of laughs about it, and that's that. And so I feel like he's okay. I'm not overly concerned about that. There is probably a bigger dichotomy between a young girl sitting there with an older man than two boys sitting there in a room chatting it up.
Yeah. I'll just say that what we do is Margie or I always accompany our daughters in an interview. And it's, I don't know if it's uncomfortable for the bishopric. They know now to ask us before they ever pull anyone in to an interview. And one of us always accompanies. And that's how we do it.
John, so you must have approached the bishopric then and explained this to them.
Yeah, we did. We just said,
What did you say? Because, see, I felt like if we did that, they would feel like we distrusted them, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I had to have this conversation just last week with our executive secretary. First of all, I never had to have it with the bishop or the bishopric. I had to have it with the executive secretary because he's the one who calls and says, hey, can we set up an appointment? And it was them that I just said something very candidly. I said, listen, this is going to be a little bit uncomfortable. I want you to know that I really respect and trust you guys. This isn't about any personal animosity, but I'm a little uncomfortable with our daughters being alone in a room with a man, even though I trust everybody, but sometimes mistakes happen. And occasionally I've heard of young young girls or young boys being asked questions that maybe weren't quite appropriate, and we just feel more comfortable being there. And somehow the word just got around in the ward that we were weird that way, and our daughters are pretty cool with it because they don't want to be alone in a room with a grown man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're right. That's kind of creepy for them, even though they don't like it when mom and dad are always a little bit different. That bugs them.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been able to be cool with this, and our bishopric's been really supportive.
Well, I have this idea that we could fall back on. I mean, the church definitely has made some moves in the last, I don't know, maybe decade, I think. In reaction to maybe some problems that have happened, not necessarily in interviews, but definitely like you can't have a male primary teacher.
What a great rule, right?
Yes. And so you're not, I think that there's a rule with scouting also. There's not just supposed to be one man that's there. So I have this idea in my head that I could sort of bring that up because then I'm sort of bolstering my argument with the church policy, which I shouldn't have to do. But again, that's sort of the framework that we're dealing with, that maybe it's just smart to err on the side, you know, on the side of caution and just, you know, be extra careful with our kids, like these other policies.
Well, Lee, go ahead, Lori.
I was just going to say, I think, though, if we're going to walk this non-conventional Mormon path, we're going to have to become okay with being that parent.
Right.
One that's okay with saying what we believe and calling the bishop and saying, you know, I'm not okay with this. And I love how John, you always frame things in a way that doesn't attack people, doesn't threaten people, doesn't put anybody on the offensive, right? We're all in here together. We all want the best thing for our kids. And
totally.
Fearless.
Well, Lee, I keep asking you the question last, and I think you always get the short end of the stick. So I'm going to ask you a question first, all right?
Okay.
Are there any issues with the young men's program that we need to be conscious about, analogous to the ones that Lori and Heather mentioned about the young women's program that you come to mind for you?
Oh, beyond the masturbation thing?
Well, that is really the only topic.
No, it's scouting. Scouting has been a major issue for the church, and I think if you have a scouting program attached to the church and to the ward, and I think most wards do, that is a major defining moment for most of the young men who grow up. It certainly was for my son. My son experienced, I think, pretty significant involvement with the church up until he was about 13 or 14. He went through the early scouting program. He was a Cub Scout. He was a Weebelos. But the minute he got to being a Boy Scout, it just didn't resonate with him. What he really liked was sports. And they kept making a direct link between priesthood development, young men development, personal development, and scouting program. And if you were not involved in scouting, then you are no longer a worthy priesthood holder, no longer a worthy human being. And he was getting lots and lots of messages connected to that. And, you know, we were giving him backing completely and 100%. And so I don't think he ever felt devalued or had diminished self-image or self-perception based on this. But it culminated in a member of the bishopric coming to him one time and said, look, you're not attending seminary. You're not attending your priesthood meetings. You're not going to scouting. It's going to compromise your ability to get into BYU. And he had no desire to become a cougar. And this member of the bishopric couldn't fathom that. And at that point, my son quit going to church. He just said, I give up.
That's too bad.
I don't feel that this is a good fit for me anymore.
I mean, it's too bad for the church. That's the church's
loss. It is. Yeah. It is. Because he's a gifted leader, and he's got so much to offer. Mm. And he has great values.
All right. Other stuff that we need to be wary of or thoughtful about regarding the young men's program. Anyway, I mean, there's making sure that just like our girls don't get the message that they're lesser, you know, there's obviously the idea of making sure our boys don't get the idea that they're better.
Well, either that they don't get the idea that they're better. I worry about that. That seems like the most obvious conclusion in my very unobjective opinion. But they could also get the message that they're broken, that they're, you know, they needed the priesthood. You know, women don't need it because they're just naturally so good, whereas men are naturally bad. Therefore, they needed this extra thing to help them because surely on their own they couldn't do anything worthwhile. So that's the sort of the opposite message, but that's equally equally worrisome, that they're defective.
Right. Right.
No, my experience with young men, because I've got a 14-year-old, is has been largely positive. He's the only boy his age in our ward, and he goes, and he enjoys it. And he slacks big time on the scouting, and we support that. And he passes the sacrament with his hair down his back, and the ward members call him sheepdog, his hair. And we all laugh about it, and I see him, you know, that's this tight, be laid back kid, and I see him, I offered, you know, I tried to buy him a blue shirt, and he wants to wear a white shirt, and he wants to wear a tie, and he wants to serve people once a week by passing around a tray of bread, and, you know, that seems to have been the extent of it. So far, so good. Mm-hmm. Except the main message seems to be that we have to fight against this horrible world, but he doesn't seem to be, I don't know, as affected.
Maybe your leadership trumps that.
I don't know.
You're in Dan's leadership.
Time will tell. He'll probably blame us years from now.
All right, well, I'm going to just throw out one more elephant in the room that you guys may or may not be aware of, but I am because I'm in the field of psychology, and that's the issue of pornography. You know, you can't have not just a general conference, but a general conference session go by where pornography isn't denounced and decried. And I just have to imagine that in young men's, they've never allowed me to serve in young men's. I've never been called, but my guess is that pornography is mentioned there as well. And I just have to express my own concerns about one small aspect of that. My thesis and dissertation are on OCD and, you know, and anxiety disorders, specifically as they relate to, you know, religious or moral upbringings. And I've dug into the literature a bit to understand intrusive thoughts and what is it that creates an intrusive thought, these sort of thoughts that are uncontrollable, that make people feel like they're going crazy because they get these urges to stab somebody or jump off a building, or they can't get sexual thoughts out of their mind. And one of the things that the literature seems to be very, very clear on is that the worst way to get rid of a thought, the absolute worst way to get rid of a thought, and in fact, the way that you guarantee that the frequency of the thought will increase, and increase not only in frequency but in severity, is to tell someone not to have the thought. That is the most guaranteed way. So if I said to all of you right now, do not think of a chocolate donut. Whatever you do, do not think of a chocolate donut. I'm going to give you 30 seconds, and I command you to do everything in your power to not think of a jelly donut. And in fact, if you think of a jelly donut, you might go to hell. Go. Okay? And I'll give all of you 15 seconds to just not think of a jelly donut or a chocolate donut. 10, 11. Okay, how many of you weren't able to do it? And this is just a silly scientific experiment that illustrates a very important point. And that's that the extent to which we compulsively tell people to not look at porn and to not look at women scientifically seems to guarantee that they will, and probably even increase the frequency and severity. Now, there may be people who are going to disagree with me, but I tend to feel like we're creating a double bind with our young men as we do this behavior. And it becomes a problem because then they're viewed as unworthy to go on missions, and they feel all this guilt and self-loathing if they happen to view pornography, which seems to be more and more common. And I just want to give my two cents on what the right way to deal with pornography is. And I think this might be controversial. I don't even know that I'm right, but what I can probably offer as someone who's trying to study these issues is, number one, stigmas are likely to increase the problem, not lessen the problem. Guilt is likely to increase the severity of the problem, not lessen it. you know, obviously you're not going to teach your sons to love porn and to go after it. And you probably would even want to teach them about its dangers and its perniciousness from what I think Lori tried to advocate, which is sort of a intelligence and a smart, reasonable perspective. But I want to feel like we might consider advocating for the destigmatization of pornography to the extent that we're telling people not to do it in ways that's actually going to increase its use and increase the damage ultimately done to the souls of these young men. Now, please tell me I'm full of crack, smoking crack. Please tell me I'm wrong. But I want to throw that out there and see if you guys have ideas, because I'm open.
John, can I respond first on that one?
Please.
You may or may not know this, but back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, one of the questions they asked missionaries in their interviews before they went on missions, both bishop and stake president interviews, was, have you ever had sex with a farm animal? I kid you not.
No, I know. I've heard that.
And so they asked me that question in August of 1970 when I was being interviewed to go on my mission to Japan. And I said, I'm sorry. I thought I heard you say something about it. The bishop went red in the face and said, yeah, well, we're supposed to ask this. And I said, why? And he said, well, I don't know, but it's just part of what we're supposed to ask. And obviously you haven't, so let's move on to the next question. And it became a topic of conversation with the stake president, who was as curious about it as I was. And we had actually a fairly entertaining conversation about it. When I got back from my mission and I went into this same stake president to do my interview with him at the end of my mission, he said, by the way, that question that we had a chuckle over back in August of 1970, they've removed it. Right. And I said, why? And he said, well, it's not only a stupid question, but here's the problem. They started experiencing an increased incident
exactly.
of 19 and 20-year-old kids spending too much time with farm animals.
Yeah, Idaho kids just don't have a chance.
Yeah, and evidently this had been going on for quite some time, that they had been triggering thoughts that hadn't otherwise occurred to people when they would go in for their missionary interviews. So what resonated with me, John, is that whole notion of excess and going overboard being triggered by this scarcity mentality is a reality. I really think there's something to it. On the other issue of pornography and the evils of it, I'm reminded of what my friend experienced when he went on his mission at back in the 70s. You went 3 days in the general headquarters of the church in Salt Lake and had 3 days of indoctrination and a little bit of brainwashing. And they always brought up the question of the guys who had had premarital sex and had chronic problems with masturbation and were looking at pornographic materials to fuel those pernicious evils. And one guy who had a psychology background stood up with my friend's group and said, if you feel like masturbating, just do it and don't obsess over it. And that was the last time he spoke before a missionary group. But to the point that I'm trying to make, I think there is something to the fact that if you keep driving this point home over and over and over again, you may lead people to the very evil that they're trying to avoid. Another friend in Salt Lake had a son who was prevented from going on a mission because he didn't fit within the six-month window of having recently masturbated, and the stake president who pulled his opportunity from him was the very stake president that got arrested for soliciting sex and was the guy who headed up the pornography commission of the church and became so addicted to looking at pornography with this group really looking at the evils of pornography, that he got on that slippery slope into a myriad of other kinds of deviant sexual behaviors.
Yeah, he was a lawyer for Kirtland and McConkie, the church's law firm.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that.
Yeah, and a stake president. Yep.
Yep. Stake president.
Cool. Yeah.
He was the stake president who prevented my friend's son from going on his mission.
That's painful.
What's the 6 month thing?
That's, I don't know, local policy or something they used to do. I don't know.
Something they
still
used
in
to
place,
do.
John. I think it's still in place. If you masturbate, you are not deemed mission worthy.
So you have to have a 6 month window.
Yeah, they send the young man home and say, discipline yourself, read the scriptures daily, engage in pure thought and action, and come back in 6 months and we'll reexamine it. If you have not masturbated in 6 months, then we'll reconsider it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that goes the way of the farm animal.
John, you may want to check that. I think that's still the standing.
It could be.
It may not be a policy, but it's clearly a procedure.
I guarantee you there are mission presidents who let that slide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where there may
be. Which also means that there are kids who bend the truth.
Yeah, right. Yeah, who just lie. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're encouraging lying. Well, again, I'm not advocating for porn. I think porn's insidious, you know, and dangerous, but I think most importantly for parents with boys, I think you need to watch out about the messages for their self-worth and their evil, etc., and make sure that, you know, that you help let that not happen. So, enough said.
Amen.
All right. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.